Good evening, everybody. My name is Adrian Clark, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm recovered. I'm very aware that I can become unrecovered if I stop following the plan that I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous through this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here tonight because, you know what, I've found a way that works for me just as good as alcohol did. You know, I was thinking about that in the way over in the car today, and, you know, I just wished that it would work faster for people and we could all stay here, you know? And I'm one of the people that, you know, I've had to work hard, and, you know, I've got a couple of sponsees at the minute, and they're struggling, you know, they're struggling really hard. And they're sober for, one of them sober 13 years, and one of them sober 8 years, you know? And I was talking to both of them yesterday, and, you know, I think we got to be honest with guys, you know? I think there's a myth around spirituality. And there's a myth around Alcoholics Anonymous that if you do this, that everything's going to be perfect. Stay away from them people. They're crazy. You know, the people that are just perfect all the time and sound good all the time. There's been times in my recovery doing this deal till it's been falling out of my ears that I've just wanted to lie down on the floor and die. You know? I've experienced a lot of pain and a lot of growth, you know? So I think it's important for us to be real, you know? And I think sometimes, you know, when I'm talking to guys like that are really struggling and I'm praying and I want to say something to them that can help them, because that's our job, to be of maximum service. And something came to me yesterday. You know, I think when, from my experience, there's been times where I've kind of used this to kind of separate myself from people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and think that I'm different and that I'm special, you know. It's just some of the weird games that the ego's played with me through this book. Because when we have a spiritual experience, the ego has a spiritual experience too. But it normally has it before we do. It's through the other side, sharpening the knives up, you know. Here we go, Adrian, let's go in here and hit them with the new information that you got, you know. But I think when we're on the path, and we're struggling, and we really don't know where we are, I think we're really on the path, you know. When provided we're taking the actions, you know. And that's a great place to be. You know, I think there's been, if I had just had a plain ceiling in here all the time, I don't think I would have stayed. You know? And I've been brought through this book. This Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place I've ever felt okay with myself, you know, and I've tried different things. I've tried a lot of different drugs, you know, booze. I just tried just about everything that I could think of that was available to me. I just wanted to feel okay. I think Mike shared it there a couple. He just wanted to wake up one morning and feel okay, you know. And that was kind of like me. So, you know, I told my story the first week and probably bored you all to death, you know, because I get bored telling it sometimes now at this stage of the game, you know. And, you know, that first step, there's a powerful concept in there, you know, that you're powerless over alcohol. Wow, who would have thought that? You know, that was when that was kind of like put in front of me. I was like, that was an unbelievable concept, you know. I mean, I surrendered to the booze many times on hangover morning. But I'd never surrendered to the idea that there was a higher power that could take me past my problem. You know, so there was a big shift in the first step when I got the information that was given to me about the three-part illness, the three-part solution. And then when I got into the second step, and this all took time in Alcoholics Anonymous, so it did for me, and, you know, different workings with the steps and stuff. It just didn't happen 1, 2, 3, you know. I mean, this happened at different periods of time. You know, there was different kind of meridians of shifts and changes that kind of happened within me. And I think one of the biggest shifts that came for me was in the second step. You know, and then when I'm sharing on the fourth and fifth step tonight, I'm sure I'll probably say the same thing. One of the biggest shifts came for me was in the fourth step. It was an absolute change in perception for me. In the fourth and fifth step, but, you know, that change in perception kind of started to happen in the second step to me, that there's an idea that there's a power that can take me beyond my problems, and I kind of talked about that, so that was a shift too. And then last week, you know, when I was talking about step three, I read something out of the book where I said, you know, I think there's many concepts in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the one most important to me, I think the one most important, the life-changing concept that has changed my life to this day and continues to change it, is the idea of me quitting playing God. Yeah. You know? That's the linchpin for me right there. If I can quit playing God, then Everything kind of gets back into the flow again, you know. I get reminded, you know. And I don't think we can ever quit playing God full time, you know. But here's the thing. They're asking me here, we had to quit playing God. I didn't even know I was playing him. Hold on a minute. I didn't even know I was playing God. And now that you've mentioned it, you know what? I've actually been playing him my whole life. Now I can see it. You know? And, you know, one of the things, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in Belfast, I was in so much pain, so much psychological pain. That's why I drank, because of psychological pain. It was like someone was playing the drums in my head. I was full of fear, just self-centered to the core, couldn't stop thinking about myself. I was coming from a dark place. And an old lady said to me, she says, you know, Adrian, it's your fault that you're here. And I wanted to believe her, but I didn't know what she meant by that. I didn't believe her, but on a deeper level, I knew she was kind of telling me something. She wouldn't just say that, you know. And I said, well, can you explain to me why it's my fault that I'm here? And it talks about a self-imposed crisis in here. You know, it's my fault that I'm sitting in this room tonight. I made the decisions, or I was driven by whatever it was that made me make the decisions to kind of just burn my life to the ground. And, you know, I started to find that out through inventory. And that took time for me. My first inventory, I got sober in the Lisburn Road group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Belfast, South Belfast. And I'm from West Belfast, but I went to South Belfast because I didn't want anybody from my neighborhood seeing me in the meetings, you know. I mean, heaven forbid, you know. I mean, it's okay to see me peeing on your lawn at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know? It's all right for me to kind of, you know, crash my car into your garden, get out and walk away. But heaven forbid you see me getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And that's just some of the crazy stuff that went on in my mind, you know. And the people in there, they were great people. That's the second oldest group in Ireland, and there's such a great history behind that group, you know. There really is. I'm very proud to come from that group of people. When I got there, there was a lot of people were over 40 years and 30 years and 20 years, and they all just wanted to be helpful. You know the old saying, it takes a village to raise a kid, you know. That whole group sponsored me. And I don't be doing that, you know. I mean, have a sponsor. I had a sponsor in the group as well, but everybody helped. When I came in there, everybody wanted to be helpful. You know, there was people that I trusted in that group were my life. And, you know, but they knew what they knew about the Big Book. I would have called them a Big Book group at the time, but they didn't work with the Big Book the way I've learned to work with it now. You know, I've learned to, when a guy comes to me for help, one of the first things I'll ask him is, have you ever done every word that the Big Book says? From the front cover to page 164. And you'd be surprised how many people in Alcoholics Anonymous with time that have not done that. There's more people that answer no to that question than what answer yes to it. You know? And that's fine. Listen, you've done what you've done, and you're here, and you've done... I'm not here to critique the way anybody works steps. There's many paths up the mountain. You know, there really is. So if you do it a different way or whatever, you know, we can always have an argument after the meeting about it. You know, I'm just joking, by the way. Give them more coffee, Mike, will you? Jesus Christ. Put something in it, you know. So if you do it differently, you know, that's cool too. You know, and I like to hear how you do it as well. I like to hear how the other guy's doing it. So, you know, but by the time I came to do my fourth step in that group, when I first came around, my sponsor just told me to write my life story out. You know, and I started to do that, and, you know, there was all this pages of stuff. But all it really was just a whole bunch of stuff about me where I'd messed up. You know, more bad stuff about me. I mean, I'd stored all this stuff in my head, and, you know, I was writing it out, and it was painful, and the ink was dripping all over the page because my tears were on it, and, you know, the FBI wouldn't have found it because I had it hid so far away, and it was all junk, it was garbage. I'll share any bit of it with... Well, maybe not that bit, you know. I share any bit of it with anyone is, you know. But at this time, you know, it was so important to me because, I mean, I'm coming off the streets of Belfast and I've done things and, you know, I'm not proud of it. Now, there's things that I'm ashamed of in there that I think I'm bringing to my grave with me. And I think most of us come in here like that. You know, we all have something in there. There were several things in there that I'm like, I'm having anxiety over it. How can I share this stuff with another man? You know, not just another human being, but another man, you know. And I've got it all writ down there, and, you know, and I'm trying to put them off. I'm trying to avoid them. You ever notice when a sponsee does that, when they're writing inventory, you know, all of a sudden the calls get less, and, you know, It's you don't see them at the meeting as often and stuff. And I get it because the ego, it works two ways. People have like a really fragile ego, or they have like a really thick ego. All egos are different, you know. And the real fragile ones, they can't even get the pen to paper, you know. And the real thick ones, like, you know, I have a thick ego. Anytime I sit down to write inventory, even today, you know, I hate writing inventory. You know, and anybody that, I've heard people saying they love writing inventory and stuff. Maybe I should get them, and maybe I should get the people that taught me how to write inventory to teach them it's hard to write inventory or something. I don't know, man, you know, but I do not love writing inventory. Who wants to take a look at themselves? Who wants to take a look at the truth? Who wants to be honest with themselves, you know? But I'll do it. I'll sit down and I'll do it, and it's uncomfortable. And I'm the guy, like, you know, that when I sit down to write inventory, all of a sudden it's a little stuffy, you know? And I'll get up and I'll open the window and I'll put the pen and the paper back down, and then it's like, that lemonade in the fridge is probably cold by now, you know? And before you know it, Netflix is on, you know, and it's the next day and I'm way behind on it already. And one of the things that I get guys that I work with to do is to write every day, you know, whether it's 15 minutes or 45 minutes, write every day. Because if you leave a day writing, it's harder to get back into it. And if you leave 2 days writing and then all of a sudden it's a week, it just becomes uncomfortable. You have to take care of this. So anyway, Kevin told me, if you got that, I walked into the meeting one day and it started to become psychologically battering to me, because now I've written all this stuff out and I've seen it on paper and I've brought it all up, because that's what we do when we're going to do a fourth and fifth step. That's why it's so important that we take the first three steps before that. Because we go into inventory with prayer. Next, we launch on a course of vigorous action, right? And we go in there with a third step prayer. You know, I've admitted that I'm going to, you know, I've made an agreement that I'm going to turn my will and my life over to this power, and that means absolutely nothing. I mean, I made a decision this morning that I was going to come here and do this tonight, but I had to go and get two new tires on the back of my car today. I had to get in my car, I had to set the GPS, I had to drive through the tunnel, I had to, you know, it was a whole series of events that took place for me to get here, not just the decision to get here this morning, you know. So I've made this decision, and I'm going to look at the things that are blocking me off from this power that it's promised me in the second step that resides within me. That I'm not disconnected from this power. There's three things, you know, calamity, pomp, and worship of other things that have me blocked off from this power. And it's promised me that it's inside me. And it's also promised me that if I continue along this path, that I'll gain access to this power. There's access to freedom. So when I went to Kevin's house and sat down with my life story, I started reading it out to him. And I felt desperately uncomfortable because there was stuff in there that I did not want to share with him. And halfway through it, he said, "Give me it." And he started reading all through it. And we had a conversation about it. It took about 5 or 6 hours, and we had a conversation about it. And then he brought me out the back of his house, and he burnt it. And I got to tell you, it probably bought me time in Alcoholics Anonymous. It took a little bit of the pressure off me. What it done was it got rid of some of the guilt. But you know what? I'm a champion at getting rid of guilt. I've been doing things that made me guilty from I was 5, 6 years of age. I can sweep the guilt under the rug, but there's one thing that I can't get rid of. No matter what I do, I can't get rid of it, and that's resentment. You know? I mean, resentment will get me to the point where it's like someone throws a cigar on an old dry mattress that's sitting outside in the middle of July in New York. They throw a cigar on it, and it starts to burn, and it burns, and it gets a little bit bigger. And you see the embers, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just keeps burning and burning and burning until it'll eventually just get rid of the whole mattress. And that's what resentment does for me. It just burns and burns and burns and burns to the point where today, you know, I my life was just made of resentment. I got a phone call from a guy that tried to help me in early sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous back in Ireland, and he asked me how I was doing one day. And I told him I was doing great. And then he asked me how work was going, and I proceeded to tell him how my boss was an SOB, and the guys that I was working with, I can't stand them. They're all pieces of this and pieces of that, and my mom and my dad. And he goes, "Dude, you're not doing well at all. That's resentment you have." And I'm like, "Oh, is that what that is?" And I didn't know what it was, because that was my permanent state. That's where my mind was. I just had a mind of negativity that just hated everything and everybody. Unless you give me something, I'd elect you for 5 minutes. And then I'd have found a fault in you as well. And that's where my mind was. And, you know, today, when I have a resentment, it's like someone shed poison into my system. I got to do something with it. And if I'm working a good 10-step, I got to do something with it real quick. I mean, I've had resentments. One resentment has the power to kill. I believe that one resentment has a drink down underneath it. And for me, no matter what it is, no matter what the resentment is about, I believe if I let it, it talks about harboring such feelings in here, you know, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight. And anything that shuts me off from the sunlight today is not conducive to my recovery at all. And I think one resentment has the power to kill. And I hear these cats coming in, the Alcoholics Anonymous, that have resentment inventories where 300 resentments and stuff on it. And they don't. You can boil that right down. A lot of it's the same resentment and stuff, you know. I think the biggest resentment inventory I ever had was 40, 50, and there was probably only 20 of them were real substance on that, you know. So I read it to Kevin, and, you know, off I come into the world of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start doing my thing, and I'm doing a lot of service and stuff, and I still don't know how to bring somebody through a real fourth step. And what happened to me 2 years sober, you know, I still have these resentments. They're burning. That shift in perception didn't take place because I believe because I didn't do it the way it's outlined here, you know. And I think this is one of the most transformative parts of the book right here is when we come into this fourth step. You know, there's such an opportunity for transformation here. And we'll read some of it because I know you guys are a big book group and you just want to read some of this. So it says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. And this is on 64, guys and girls. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. So it's an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. You know? The things that are boiling me down, the things that are bogging me down. One of the things that I've learned through writing this and good guidance is, in a fourth and fifth step, I don't learn who I am. I learn who I am not. This is all a false sense of self that's been created by a little false thing in between my ears. Now, there's a reality to it because I've lived it and there's trouble and there's harm and stuff caused just to say that it's, you know, it's a false sense of self and leave it at that. I mean, that wouldn't pay homage to the people that I've hurt and harmed and stuff. But this is not who I am. Who I am is going to show up later on in the process. And that's one of the things that I needed to know. The first 6 steps are going to bring me relief in my life. But I'm a relief-seeking junkie, and relief doesn't work. It's not long-lasting. So the last 6 steps are what's going to bring the freedom, you know? And I think we start to get bursts of freedom here when we write inventory. So it says, one object is to disclose damage to unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about his values. The delusion, right? Self-deception. That's one of the things that's been guiding me my whole life. So it's time to sit down and get really honest here. And there's only one way I can get really honest, through inventory. That's through prayer. You know, one of my old heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous used to say, inventory without prayer, throw it in the garbage, it's nothing. Garbage? I don't know what that is, you know, and he's right. So there's prayers that bring me into inventory. There's prayer that helps me when I'm in inventory to keep the light shining and to keep me guided. And there's prayer that guides me out of inventory. So we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Self-imposed crisis, you know. So my fault that I'm here. It's good to know that. See, if I ever did go drinking again, I'd never be able to blame it on anybody else. Learning what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd never be able to do it, you know. So being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered it as common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Resentment, not even alcohol. Resentment, you know. So I think resentment's the number one offender. But I think fear, self-centered fear, is the most consistent thing that drives alcoholics. I think the main muscle behind the ego is fear. And most of the guys that I've ever sponsored, you can hear it in them, because I can hear it in them, because that's been me as well. It's just fear. I know some people that never snap out of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. They never sweep out those closet fears and those closet resentments. And on a kind of, almost like on a cellular level, they continue to drive them and they never really get happy, you know? So I think it's important that we do deep work here in this inventory. And it's not a one-time deal for me. You know, I write inventory as I need it today. When I come in the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, after about year five was when it really got serious for me. I wrote an inventory every year and shared it with someone. I probably wouldn't do that now, but every once in a while I'll write a PC inventory and I'll call my sponsor up or my 10-step buddy and I'll share it with him. And my sponsor shares inventory with me sometimes too, which is cool. So resentment's the number one offender from it. Stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we've not only been mentally and physically ill, so mental obsession, physical allergy, right? They're bringing all parts of it into it. We've been spiritually sick. I know a lot of people in AA want to argue with me sometimes that it's only a twofold illness. Right there it tells me it's a threefold illness. Mental, physical, and spiritual. You know? So, great promise here. Love this. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I don't know about you guys, but when I came in here, I thought, if you give me 50 grand, maybe a nice brunette, nice car, that's going to be an answer to a lot of my problems, you know? And that would have been the beginning of the end for me. Thank God I didn't get what I wanted when I came here, because it would have killed me. It would have killed me. My sponsor used to say to me all the time when I'd be sitting with a big long face in the meeting, what is it you want? What do you want? Because you always want something. My mom's been telling me that from when I was a kid. You have the wants. You know? You have the wants. And I did. I had the wants. And he would say to me, you know what? See, if you got it all tonight, you'd go drinking tomorrow. And he was right. So things have had to come to me slowly. So what it's telling me here is, first of all, I have to get the spiritual house inside of me. I have to do the work on that. I have to get that clean. I have to get that clear, because I'm like a garbage peel here. Not only am I like a garbage peel, but you know what it's like? I come in the Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm carrying this heavy sack over my shoulder. And there's stuff in there from the beginning, from the first time I stole, from the first time I lied, all the lies I told, all the stealing that I'd done, you know? The times when I said yes, when I meant no, the times that I said no, when I should have said yes, all the times when I built that low self-esteem up, all those times that, it's all in there. Every time I done stuff like that, I ripped a piece of my higher self off and threw it in that sack. And that sack's my psyche. All this stuff is rumbling around in my psyche. It's entrenched into it. I love a word that from the Sanskrit language, samskara, it means etched into. Etched into my emotional body. This stuff's etched in there, and it's motivating me from a deep level. This is what's making me tick. This is why the voices in my head won't stop. This is why I can't sit in the room without having the TV on, the radio on, a book in that hand, and a computer in that hand. You know, I can't sit with myself. You know, we talk about this being a journey to God in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it 100% is. But I like this better. It's a journey back to my high self. And my high self and God, they're inseparable. It's the same thing. God is me, but I'm not God. Because I've watched a lot of people get crazy with the concept that they're God as well. That's not the way I see it, you know. But this is a journey back to my higher self. So to get back to my higher self, these are the obstacles. We're going to start to find out about what the obstacles are in my way. So we listed people. People. That's pretty simple, right? Institutions. Our principals with whom we were angry, we asked ourselves why we were angry. Most cases we find that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. You know why I come to this part of the book when I'm working with a guy? I just give him his list to make. I say, alright, make your list. You know, and give me a call of people, institutions, and principals. And if you haven't called me within 2 weeks, call somebody else. You know, just call somebody else. Because I think 2 weeks is more than enough time to make a list, right? You know, and then they make their list, they come back to me, and then I give them the next part that we're talking about here. So it says on our grudge list, we sat opposite each name, our injuries. So the first part of it's real simple. We make a list, right? Guy from my home group, you know. Second column, the cause, you know, ignores me. Thinks he's the main man, you know. There's column one, column two, done. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Be specific, do it, you know. Put it all in there, you know. And I don't care if you use swear words and stuff. Get it out. Put it down on the paper, you know. But just to say he's an a-hole, that doesn't work. We got to be specific. Column three. So it talks about areas of self here. Self-esteem. What is self-esteem? My deep down belief about myself. You know, the story that I have going underneath everything. Our security. What's my security? You know, I go to a meeting one night and there's a guy speaking, and then I'm out after the meeting going, you know what? I could have done without hearing that guy tonight. That was terrible. That was, you know, that's my security right there. I need someone to behave in a certain way so I can be okay. That's been my whole life, and that's insanity when you think about it. That's where I've been. That's where I came to the Alcoholics Anonymous. In my early days in Alcoholics Anonymous, even, you know, someone cut me off on the road and flipped me a bird. I'm memorizing their license plate, and I will see them again. You know. So driving around with all these license plates in your head is not a good place to be, you know. Delaware 1056, you know, I mean, it's crazy, absolute crazy. So that's security right there. I need the world to be a certain way. The actor and the director here, right? I need the world to be a certain way. And one of the things that I, when I'm working with new guys, I just get them to write those things, those areas of self in their third column. But when I'm working with guys that, and this really changed me too, when I'm working with guys that have been around for a while, and say that, you know, the resentment is they're annoyed at someone in their home group, or whatever it is, when I get to self-esteem is, like I said, is my belief about myself. I am. That's how that starts. So if I'm saying that someone in my home group, I don't like them because they think they're the main man, what I'm really saying is, you know, I'm a perfect member of my home group. That's what I'm saying, right? Anytime I throw a judgment out, I'm not seeing the truth. And that's the thing about resentment. There's a smoke screen that's in front of resentment that it never wants me to see the truth. And these judgments that I make, they're behind a cloak. You know, I mean, I'm driving down the road with a guy that I sponsor in the car, and sometimes they do it so, you know, cleverly. They think they're clever, but, you know, when you've done it yourself, you know they're not clever, and they'll turn around and they'll say, yeah, you know that guy from that group, that Thursday night group? Well, you know, he's a good guy and stuff, but you know what? He's a real... And I'm like, well, that's a resentment. And you'll see them snap shut right away. That's not a resentment, because the ego's just so good at protecting it. And then they'll go, no, you're right, it's a resentment, you know? So self-esteem, I am. You know, ambitions it talks about in here, I want a perfect home group, right? That's what I'm saying. I want everybody to do what I want them to do in my home group. I want it to be perfect. I want them to speak nothing but recovery. I mean, this is some of the madness that I found in inventory about myself. What does it matter what anybody else is doing? Security starts with I need. I need him to behave. I need everybody to behave a certain way in my home group. And that starts to crack my ego there. When you write inventory the other way, just it says here, the ego kind of doesn't get cracked until the fourth column. And if you look at the first three columns of the inventory, I'm resentful at, we'll use the examples here, Mr. Brown, the cause is attention to my wife, affects my sexual relations, self-esteem. It's kind of like therapy, isn't it? You know? Who are you angry at? How does it make you feel? You know? Why are you angry? And that's as far as most of us ever get that it said here, those three things. So, tells us to go back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. It's apparent that this world, page 66, in this world were people often quite wrong. So to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. You know, that's me right there. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and everybody else was wrong. Like the conversation I had with that old lady, I still thought that I was doing the right thing. There was just something off in my life that I ended up here. And how wrong I could have been, I was absolutely wrong about everything. Everything. I was wrong about everything. And it says, the usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we restored ourselves. I'll tell you, at 5 years sober, I still had a resentment for my first ever boss. Not that I have one for him. I had about 7 or 8 for him. He was on there more times than anybody, and I just couldn't see the truth about it. You know, and there it was, resentful at the boss, you know, why didn't pay me enough money. My sponsor, when we was listening to me inventory, says, well, did you ever ask them for a pay raise? And I was like, well, no. He says, well, why not? And I says, because I was afraid. He says, afraid of what? I said, afraid. I didn't think I was worth a better job than that, and I needed that money to drink. He says, did you ever sit down? And you know what? It tells me here to look at this from an entirely different angle. When I started to look at this stuff from an entirely different angle, I seen how wrong I was. I seen how wrong I'd been. I seen how that boss took care of me. He came and picked me up on mornings when I'd just come out of blackouts in different parts of town and brought me and took care of me and, you know, would give me subs and, you know, would buy me food and would bring me to his house. And I started to see, because the ego doesn't want me to see the truth. When I cast a judgment out, the ego never wants me to see the goodness in someone, you know? And all I do is see the badness in you. You know, like my friend says, I start building cases on you right away. And, you know, resentment comes in 4 stages. The first stage is that I make an unrealistic expectation on you. So I make these covert deals with you. If you're my boss, you're my friend, I put these expectations, and I subconsciously I'm doing it up front. I'm not even aware I'm doing it. And the second phase is, first stage is I put the expectations on you. The second phase is you don't live up to it. And the third stage is I start to feel angry. And the fourth stage is I start to relive the anger and relive the anger and relive the anger. And I bring it home with me. And I'm angry at my boss. Why? Because he talked down to me in front of everybody. And I bring it home with me, and I'm sitting having my dinner, and I'm watching TV, and I turn the TV off because I want to watch this TV, and I want to feed into it, and I'm thinking, you know what, see, tomorrow I'm going to go in there, I'm going to walk into work, and I'm going to wait till he's in front of everybody, and I'm going to shoot him down. You know? And I go into work the next morning, plan that out in my head, discussing it with myself, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and the boss walks in, and I go, oh, good morning, Pete, how you doing? You know? How you doing, you know? And then I go home with an even bigger resentment. Thank God for sponsors, because I never knew how to deal with situations like that. They never taught me at school what to do when you're afraid or, you know, how to deal with someone that's kind of like showed you up or whatever. And, you know, there's a simple solution to that we'll learn in the 10th step. You call the boss to the side and say, listen, I didn't appreciate the way you talked to me in front of everybody the other day there, but in future, could you pull me to the side? I'm very approachable if you want to have a chat with me and stuff. And you know how many times I've turned around and apologized for their part of it, for their piece of it? So, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff here, and I think it's really important, so I'm going to read it. And it says, it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness to the precise extent that we permit these. Do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Like, the rest of the page here is just threatening me with my life. You know, Bill does it in a very obvious way here. Here's what's going to happen to a guy like me who has alcoholism like me if I don't do what it says here, you know. And I've lived both sides of this, believe me. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, not the actual spiritual experience. Big difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. Anytime we have spiritual experiences, when we're telling our friends about them, we're already speaking about them in past tense. It's over. Awakening is a thing that's momentarily, that it happens moment to moment. So it's the maintenance and growth of this spiritual experience, not actually what happened. And so this business of resentment, infinitely grave, we find that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. So there's several parts of the book where it threatens me, I'm going to drink again. It warns me that I'm going to drink again. Here's one right here, resentment. And I truly believe that today. I've seen people with double-digit sobriety go drinking over resentment. Over resentment. That's a real thing right there. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal man. Dubious, doubtful. Luxury, not necessity. Normal man, not me. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. Poison. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. I love this. This is great. And this is, like I said, one of the ultimate transformative aspects of the fourth step and the 12 steps here. So we begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? So, talking about these resentments must be mastered. So I must be a slave to these resentments if they're using the word master, right? And I was. I didn't know how to shake this stuff off. We could not waste them away any more than alcohol. This was our recourse. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. So not only are they sick, but I'm sick too. Still today, you know. If I hang in for another couple of days, I'm going to have 19 years on Tuesday. And, you know, I'm still a dude that needs to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That idea that I'm like normal man presently or maybe has to be smashed. I got to continue to come here and grow spiritually. Or else, if I don't grow spiritually, there's something else that grows in my mind. And that's the deal here. It says, so we ask God to help them. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. So this is about me not being angry. This is not about the other guy at all. This is about me not being angry. It just said it there. So we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view. And that's a prayer that I use right there before I go into the fourth column. And it's a prayer to ask God to take the anger away and to help him to show me to see truth here. So, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. And one of the things that my old sponsor was big on, and he goes, it's real clear there, we're not talking about having parts, you know. It's talking about putting out of your mind completely the wrongs others have done. There's no parts. And, you know, he used to do this thing where he'd rip a little piece of paper off and a big piece of paper off, and he'd go, the big piece of paper, that's your part, and this is my little part right here, you know. It's telling me to squash that idea completely, you know. And looking at it from an entirely different angle, I was sober many years, and I was meditating one day, and all this stuff started coming up in me, because when you meditate, that's what happens, stuff comes up, you know. And something that I had buried underneath everything for many years was that I had a lot of shame over this, you know, that I was bullied. When I was a young little guy, you know, I mean, I was tall and skinny, and I had like an 8-inch chest, you know, I mean, and, you know, this kid bullied me, and he danced on me, and he kicked me, and, you know, and I started to sweep that under the rug right away, and I was afraid to fight back, and, you know, and this comes up in my life when I'm like 40 years of age. I mean, how do you deal with it? You know, I mean, I didn't do anything wrong. I was bullied. You know, and I think there's a lot of people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous that have been abused. You know, we say in here, you know, that, you know, that's a victim. You know, I believe I was a victim in that situation right there. And I was afraid to even share this with my sponsor. Because, you know, when I hit about the 15 mark and really started to drink and really started to fill out, I became somewhat of a bully myself. It was payback time, you know. And I had a little black book, and if you messed around with little Adrian, well, my big Adrian was going to sort you out. And I became a very aggressive person that led to a lot of violence, and a lot of people got hurt in the crossfire of that. And I'm sitting with this, and one of the things that my sponsor got me to do, he says, well, listen, let's look at this from an entirely different angle, like it says here, and I want you to do that in a prayerful, meditative way. I just don't want you to start writing stuff down. And I remember sitting with that and sitting with that and sitting with it. And the truth started to come to the surface. And, you know, You know, the theme of this workshop's love. And if you don't have love in your life, you'll never heal, because love is the only thing that can heal. The mind can't heal anything. We need love to heal the mind. We need love to heal those dark wounds. And that's real hard for people like us who are entrenched with resentment, and we come here and we can't get free of it. And here I am now, and I'm looking at this from an entirely different angle. And what I started to write on the paper was, I started to look at the home that this guy came from. He came from a broken home. I started to see the clothes that he wore. I started to see that why a guy like that would be jealous of a guy like me. And I started to see things about his life, and the tears started to trickle down my cheek. And one of the things that I felt before I even made it to the fourth column with the stuff of how I carried it and stuff all these years, and the guilt and the shame and the remorse, was I felt a deep compassion for this guy. A deep compassion. You know? And that was it. That was the work done. And it started to filter out. And how do I know I'm healing from this stuff? Well, it's real simple for me. Anytime these people would come into my consciousness or into my mind or whatever, I'd have this, you know? I'd be like ready to throw my phone off walls and stuff. And what started to happen was this guy would come into my consciousness, and the anger, the emotion wasn't there anymore. And that's happened to me where nearly every resentment I've put pen to paper on, the emotion's not there anymore. That's called giving it to God. That's getting rid of the obstacles that block me in my path right there. That's giving it to God. And now when I think about that guy, I don't know where he is or what he's doing with his life today. And his name was Spike, by the way. You know, of course it was. You know? You know? And I wonder what would happen if I ever run into him again. You know? Maybe I'd have a conversation and a cup of coffee with him. I don't know. But I'll tell you what, one of the things that I had to do, little Adrian that got bullied back there, big Adrian now, another thing my sponsor gave me to do was a meditation, was to go back in meditation. The man that I am today, 6'1", you know, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous with God in my life, was to go back and visit that little Adrian character that took that bullying and stuff back then and lay it to rest, and to tell him that he was okay now and he was getting taken care of. And these are powerful shifts. These are powerful shifts on this path. See, by the end of this workshop, you're going to think I'm full of shifts. You know? So we'll write the inventory in the three columns. The first three columns is a lie. It's just lies. It's delusion. It's what I believe myself to be. And now when we get to the fourth column here, and we've said the prayer, we're going to ask ourselves four questions. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. So we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. And we admitted our wrongs honestly, and were willing to set these matters straight. That's the tough part right there. I think this is the first real piece of work we've really had to do. Because the first three columns is real easy. It really is, you know. And this is where the writing needs to be for me. This is where I really can and need to dig deep and ask God for guidance here. You know, my selfishness, my self-centeredness, it all has to go on paper here. You know, I love working with new guys. I really do. And I have one that has, he had 53 days yesterday, and I picked him up when he had about 18 days. And I love working with new guys that, you know, they're hungry and they're eager. So they are, but they haven't even got close to seeing the truth yet. See, if you're new, by the way, your problem's way worse than what you think it is. It really is. You're screwed, you know. And I'll tell you something else. My first year in Alcoholics Anonymous was very difficult, and then every year just got more difficult and more difficult. I'm just joking. You know, and I was talking to Mike before the meeting about this. You know, I have this guy, and he's 53 days, and he's calling me up every other day, and his brother's the problem, just how I used to be. And you know, he's taking the bull by the horns and total self-will run riot, and he's running in and You know, he's causing damage all over the place, and then he's feeling worse, and then it's his boss. And because we have a lot of problems when we get here. Well, we think we have a lot of problems, but we really only have one problem that looks like many. And, you know, I give him the nutcracker the other day. You know, I give him the fourth column on the phone because I was sick listening to him, to be honest with you, you know. And I done to him what my sponsor done to me. And he's telling me it all. And he says, you know what, man, I don't know what my problem is. And I said, oh, that's my invitation right there. You know, I said, would you like to know? Yeah, absolutely, man. And, you know, he's so consumed by self that he hasn't got a clue what's coming next. Because I didn't. I was insulted. And I said, all right, well, see that time the other day there when you went in and straightened your brother out and stuff because he hurt your mom and dad? I said, did your mom and dad ask you to do that? He goes, nope. You know, I said, well, that's selfish and self-centered. I said, see your boss, he writ you up today, and he gave you the riot act and everything. I says, is it because you're not pulling your weight? He goes, yeah. I says, you're not showing up in time, are you? He goes, no. I says, you're not where you're supposed to be every day? He goes, no. I says, that's self-centered. I says, you want to know what your problem is? He goes, what? I says, you're selfish and self-centered. And it was like somebody dunked him on the head with a hammer. And there was a whole bunch of other stuff I said to him, too. And, you know, when I met him the next day, I said, you know, man, I'm sorry for taking... I wasn't really, but I just said this to him. I said, you know, I'm sorry for taking the hard approach, you know. you know, I mean, you gotta work with him. You gotta throw them a bone, you know. I said, I'm sorry. No, man. He says, you know what? No one's ever talked to me like that before. I said, I know. And he says, no, I appreciate you talking to me like that. And then yesterday we sat down to do the big book. You know, he's moving along. He's in We Agnostics now, and he just burst out crying. It's like the dam burst, you know. And that's a beautiful thing when that happens. Sometimes it happens before you get the inventory. I always watch it happening in step five. Most of the time when you're sitting down and the guy's sharing all his resentment with you and he's sharing all his fear with you. And, you know, sometimes guys are cocky when they come in to do their fifth step and they're smug and stuff and that. And, you know, it's like, you know, everybody else is still the problem. And I'll just stop them and say, all right, hold on. Is there something in your inventory that you couldn't sleep about last night? Is there something in there that you're ashamed to talk to me about? Well, yeah. I said, why don't you read me that one right now? And they read that, and you see that whole cockiness, and because this is about ego deflation. This is about getting right-sized. This is about finding humility. I can't stay sober without humility. What is humility? I don't know what all this stuff is when I come in here. It's something that I kind of grew into. And with all these shifts in the first step and the second step and stuff, all this stuff's going on. I don't know what's going on. I don't know it. I can't see it because all I can see is what's going on in here. And then eventually when you do a fourth and fifth step and you start to feel a little more freer and you start to walk up in through six and seven and you start to walk up in through eight and nine and you start rapping on doors and you start writing letters and you start making phone calls, you get to kind of look down the mountain and you see where God's been carrying you and you see that you're being taken care of. And God will always show me when I'm doing this and I'm showing up wholeheartedly and sincerely to do this that he's taking care of me. And I get glimpses of that and I get moments of that. I can't take all this at once. I really can't. If God was to clean that sack out that I'm carrying all at once, I wouldn't be able to handle that. That would just be just too big of a transformation from all this stuff that we're carrying, all these resentments and all these fears and everything that I'm carrying to just being okay like that. I wouldn't be able to function in life. My ego wouldn't be able to take it. So Alcoholics Anonymous is something in the 12 steps, is something that's designed to do that slowly over a period of time. And thank God for that. Because I've had spiritual experiences on my journey where stuff's come up pretty quick and pretty fast, and I'll tell you, it's disorientating. It really is. And I don't think that's for everybody. You know, what's for you, God will bring to you. And he won't bring you anywhere where he won't protect you. You know, so if there's somebody in the room tonight and they haven't done their fourth step yet, I encourage you to do it. I don't care what you got on there. I've heard a lot of stuff. I've heard a lot of stuff, you know. I've heard ex-gangsters, you know, people that enjoy having sex with different species. You know, I've heard it. And you know what? I don't judge people today. I really don't, because it's just where life has brought them and where life has brought me. Talks about fear. Says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside. And we're at the bottom of 67 here. Meg, what time did I go to?
30:35.
All right, well, I'm going to do something real quick with fear. I'm sorry. And next week's my last week, and this always happens, you know. So we just do what we can do, you know, and hopefully somebody got something out of it. I know I've got a lot out of it tonight, hanging with you guys, because there's a really, really nice vibe in the room tonight, you know. You know, this is a real gift, this book. It really is. I don't understand why an alcoholic wouldn't want to be in this, you know. And it's easy for me to say that at the other side of things. And I'm sure there'll be other things that I have to go to under the other side of. But, you know, this is the thing that's really transformed my life, you know. So it's saying that fear, we notice that. So if we turn back, it says, alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and the wife. So if I turn back a page, it says, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, the cause is attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress, affects my sex relations, self-esteem, fear. Something that sign right there?
Mistress.
He has a mistress, right? No, I don't like to be judgmental. Maybe he had an agreement with his wife, you know. So fear is bracketed there. If he doesn't have the mistress, he doesn't have the fear. That's the point I'm trying to make, right? So it says, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. So here's the inventory. And I brought a little fear inventory. So it says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Column 1. We asked ourselves why we had them. Column 2. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. And this is how I write fear inventory. That's column 3. Perhaps there's a better way. It's column 4. All right, so it says we make our lists in the we list our fears in the first column. Here's one for you. Fear not being liked. That's one that's still with me. That's been with me from the beginning. You know, fear of not being liked. And I'd go as far as saying everything that I've done, every action that I had taken in my life up until one point was just to win somebody or something's love. You know, wanted to be loved. You know what, there's a friend of mine says, we are people who need special attentions just so we can feel average. You know, it's true, right? You know, so fear of not being liked. Why do I have the fear? Column 2. Because I need people to like me. I need them to like me. So I can strengthen this thing that I shouldn't be strengthening, this sense of self. You know, how has self-reliance failed me here? I'll tell you. Self-reliance failed me by when I'm trying to get someone to like me, I'll gossip to him about other people. Oh, did you hear about this guy here? You know, see how he does a fourth step? You know, I mean, petty. Right. You know, it's just petty. So it is. You know, manipulating, that's another thing. I'll manipulate people into getting to like me. And the bottom line is, and with this piece of fear inventory I've written, I just don't be authentic. When I start to become a phony when I want people to like me. And for most of the time today, I don't need people to like me. I have screaming matches with my boss all the time still, you know. I think a bit of confrontation's good sometimes, you know, just to get it out, you know. I'm just joking, by the way. But, you know, I'm not being authentic. So what perhaps is a better way here? I really need to turn my lights on in the 10th step here and watch what's coming out of my mouth. Listen to what's coming out of my mouth about other people. And when I find myself gossiping about someone else, to someone else, I'll turn around and I'll say, you know what, I apologize for saying that about that guy there. You know, I shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. And nip it in the bud right there. And if I'm really working a good 10-step, it doesn't get that far. It doesn't get that far. And, you know, where it says here, what perhaps is a better way? I got to bring that to God. That's some 6 and 7 stuff right there too, right? I got to bring that to God. I got to bring that to God in the morning. I got to bring that behavior to God. And that's what I do. And I'm going to finish on this. And I think this is really important. And it's on 68. And it's down the bottom. And I call this the fear prayer. And you know what? I think this is one of the best prayers in the whole book. It says, we asked him to remove our fear. And this prayer comes in two pieces. That's the first part right there. We asked him to remove the fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. What would he have us be? That's an invitation into the present moment. That's what that prayer is. Whether I'm in Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks or it's lunchtime at work and my mind's getting busy and that fearful energy comes on and I'm starting to feel fear now and I'm really starting to feel disconnected, this is what I use. God, please remove this fear. What would you have me be? What would you have me be? And I could tell a whole bunch of stories about a whole bunch of experiences I've had with just using this. What a transformative prayer this is. I don't have time to do it, but I will tell you this. What it's done for me, this prayer, in cleaning this house out that we've talked about here. And we're not going to get to the relationship stuff, but, you know, what it's done for me is it's given me a relationship of intimacy with this world as intimate as I've ever been. And when I ask God to remove this fear, and the fear's still there, and I keep asking him to remove it, what would you have me be? You'd have me be a man with my eyes open, looking at what's going on in the world, really. Because I never really know what's going on. This doesn't know what's going on. There's a synchronicity that takes place, and that opens me up to potential to start to see other things, and I start to look across the street and see a guy and a girl, they're holding hands, and they're dating, and they're kissing, and I start thinking things like, wow, look at that, they're in love. And I start to hear things that I haven't heard before, like sounds and music. You know why? Because I'm not living like that anymore. I'm opened up. So I am. And that's available to us in here, you know. There's radical freedom. There's radical freedom available in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you meet this wholeheartedly, why wouldn't God want you to have that? Thanks for having me. Thank you.